and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are coming down your chimney thanks to the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday didn't go quite according to plan as we went down 1-0 at Burnley in a game that can only be described as scruffy. But we get a chance to get back to winning ways today as Chelsea come calling, fresh from knocking Man City off their perch last weekend. They must be running scared after resting key players for the game at Vidi on Thursday ahead of our clash at the Amex. Also this week, the club announced its annual accounts for the 2017-18 season, which revealed a profit of about 12 million quid. They can pay us next. And on Wednesday night, myself and Alan had a fine old time with Andy Rollings and Chris Catlin at a sold-out Rialto. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome a raw virgin. he's a man smothered in mystique, and I'm not talking about perfume. He is the author of the Tweeting Seagull blog. It's Phil. Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I've got your surname here, and I'm not going to tell anyone what it is.
I think just Phil the Tweeting Seagull, and that's not an instruction.
We were talking about this before, and we decided that Phil the Tweeting Seagull has come in dressed as Gully. So if you can just imagine that back home, in your sofas, on your sun lounges in Costa Rica, expat
seagull. Phil, how are you, mate? Welcome to the Albion Roar.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, very good. Cold, but
it's a bit parky. We're looking out on the open market and seeing people looking even colder, and we're actually
there's a man wearing Christmas lights on his head.
Yes. So, Phil,
I think he's drinking special brew.
Stick to football. Phil, tell us about your Albion supporting history.
Yeah. So, actually, slightly different to the two of you. I came to the club slightly later than average, I would say.
Go on.
I started supporting the Albion in 1999 when they moved to the Withdean Stadium.
Okay, and how old were you at that time?
I was about 11 or 12. So,
okay, so yeah, prime age for it.
So exactly, yeah.
Well, it's not that late, is it?
And no. Yeah, I mean, when I started getting into football, it was probably around Euro 96, that kind of time.
Okay.
So, you know, it was prime time for the Premier League and everything, and my brother and I would, on a Sunday, we'd watch Match of the Day, and I'd follow United because they'd always win, and he would follow Arsenal.
That's your brother, Facebook Seagull. Right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, right, just yes, and then when the Albion moved to the Withdean Stadium, went along a couple of times, and I think the first game we went to see was I think we beat Hartlepool 1-0.
Okay,
remember it was one of my lasting memories of that is just sitting in the south stand at Withdean. And being incredibly cold
and listening to
my brother whinge about how cold he was the whole game. And
hang on, big or little brother?
We're twins, actually.
Oh, right. Yes, okay. So, yeah, there are two Tweeting Seagulls.
Yeah, yes.
Brilliant.
Yes. And then kind of caught the bug from there. And it was, a great time to support.
Are you a local lad?
Yes, East Sussex, yeah.
Okay, so what was it that made you come to the football in the first place?
I guess it was just wanting to go watch football, really. I mean, as I say, I watched a lot on...
And you still came to Withdean.
Yes.
that was a time when we just came back to Brighton as well.
Exactly.
Wasn't it? It was a time of big excitement, really, because of the...
Well, there was for us... But I'm just thinking with Phil, who is at the outset of his football supporting history. Even as an 11-year-old, did you have any inkling of what had gone before?
I was kind of aware of it. It was national news, wasn't it? I was aware of it, but not really the context of it all and the severity of it all. I guess I was aware that the club had troubles and everything, and now
as much as an 11-year-old can be.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And I guess looking back on it now, coming to the club, I guess what I realised at the time, it was a great time to come, because obviously then you had Mickey Adams in charge, and I mean, what a man to have in charge of your club, such passion, such inspiration, and that team that then went on to win the consecutive titles. And Bobby Zamora and everything else. Oh, it's just, it was, and that from there on, it's been, I've sort of haven't been able to shake off the bug like everyone else.
I mean, it's something that we've talked about a lot in the past, Al, about the misgeneration of what we, because of what we were going through. Families weren't taking kids to the Goulston during the war years because, I mean, it was just a horrible place to be.
Absolutely.
And then obviously the exile, and you know, there was a lot of talk like where are the young fans? Where's our future generation going to come from?
They were always there. That's the point. They were always there. The latent capacity.
Charlton tried to nick them all.
Well, and I never buy into that one. It was a ridiculous folly that was. But I mean, there's parallels between Phil's story and probably ours. In as much as you're talking about Mickey Adams and Bobby Zamora, when I started supporting, it was all Alan Mullery and Peter Ward, and the bug is bitten. Now, obviously, when I started watching, we were a bit higher up. We were in the third division, and everything was Peter Ward was magic, and Mullery and Horton and all these various heroes. Whereas, you know, with Phil, he started sort of a division back. But yes, there was this certainly the upward trajectory. Like I say, as you pointed out, we just got back to Brighton. There was a genuine renewed optimism. You know, the stadium plans had gone in, and you know the light at the end of the tunnel. And even when you look back on it now, you think we were still another 10 years away from the stadium. But because of what had gone on 3-4 years previously, this was actually paradise in comparison to how it had been. So Phil has actually started watching the Albion at the right time. You know, there was the if you'd have started watching in 97, you'd have probably found it quite a turgid thing to do. Yeah. But you know,
I mean, there was also that thing that we had. I mean, we had it at the Amex for the Spurs friendly, but that friendly against Nottingham Forest, that first game, it was just everyone went there and
it was sunny. It helped.
Yeah, it was sunny. Yeah, sunny with Dean. Who knew? It was. But yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say that, and yet we say all of that, and yet at the time when I was at school at the time, and I was basically the only person in my school who followed Brighton. Everyone followed the big Premier League clubs, and there was basically me, and this is genuinely true. The other person was his dad for a period drove the team to the away game. That was it. It's so different now. You walk around Brighton and you see people wearing Brighton shirts and Brighton scarves, and it's such a different
club. So even
now,
you've noticed it in your time from the early noughties, I suppose you want to call it, where, like I say, you've got all kids wearing Barcelona and Manchester United and what have you. Even you've noticed that change.
Yes,
you
very know, much
into
so.
He lives in London.
Yeah. Well, I do see it in Brighton stuff in London now and again as well. That's probably since the Premier League, but particularly in Sussex since the Amex, it's almost a different football club.
Absolutely. So in all that time then, so we were talking about 20 years or nearly 20 years, who's your favourite Albion player?
Well, I've already mentioned him. It has to be Bobby.
Yeah.
Bobby Zamora. I mean,
was he your first hero?
He was very much so. I mean, I was in love with him from the point of that loan period where he scored six goals in six games, and then I remember when he signed for the club, and I was jumping around my parents' living room when I heard the news. It was because we knew we had someone who was going to be special, and he was. And to be honest, we were lucky to have him.
Well, it could have been Pinamonte, couldn't it?
So. It could have been.
Yeah. I think it's. I always tell this story with Zamora. You know, everyone's got their own. One of the things that we have about inviting people onto the Albion Roar is that we all had a shared experience. We were all there, whether it was starting in 99 or 2000 or whatever it might have been, or starting, you know, back in the 60s. You know, that we've all gone on this shared journey together, but everyone has their own individual story about it. Now, for instance, we all remember Zamora and his loan period and six goals. It was actually six goals in his first three games, and then the next three he couldn't be bothered. But but then when it came to about two or three days before the beginning of the season, and we thought, well, we know we've got something good. We finished the previous season brilliantly, and then it's announced that the Albion have managed to cough up $100,000 to Bristol Rovers for Zamora, and I'm on the blower to my good friend Charlie, and I said, we're going up. I said, what do you mean? He said, we've signed this Zamora fella. I said, yeah, brilliant. Go to Southend 3 days later, and we are dreadful. And
that was the one where Kuipers got
substituted at half time. But the thing is, the fact it actually turned out to be true, I can understand this. And Mickey Adams has this enormous love affair with the club. And he does still love it, even though I think he did fall out of love with the club for a while. He has this enormous love affair with the club. However, that one time where he got so upset with us lot, was because just before the teams came out, we started singing Bring On The Champions. And of course, you know, I mean, that's just red rag to a bull for the other side. And we were dreadful that day. But I think that we all knew, all the three of us, and even possibly yourself as an 11-year-old, you got to realise that there is something special about this. Like I say, there is this unquantifiable optimism, which has yet to be realised. But then what happened? We went and won the 4th Division Championship, but we knew it was going to happen. Maybe Mickey didn't realise it and didn't realise how good his squad was. Who knows? But we knew that was something a bit special, but that side.
There was something magic about that side, though. You know, I mean...
Well, magical, brutal.
Well, you know, it's partnerships all over the pitch. So you've got Watson and Zamora. You've got Oakway and Carpenter. You've got, you know, you've got...
Gary Hart, I mean...
Absolutely.
What a player. Still one of my favourites. I was tempted to say him rather than
Well,
Bobby.
Tell us about your love affair with Gary Hart then.
Well, I guess it's... I think he typifies the passion of your average supporter, I think, in the way that he plays. And I mean, by no means was he anywhere near as talented as Bobby, or as probably as most of your average Brighton players. But he had something about him which gave him that extra level, I think, performance wise.
A bit of hunger, a bit of bite.
Yeah, and you saw that even in the later years when Russell Slade came in, and he was so important to when we stayed up that year. And yeah, I think partly just for his longevity, but he had a great partnership with Bobby Zamora, didn't
he? Absolutely, yeah.
And yeah, just, I mean, what a player.
Or as he puts it, I did all the work and set up the goals for him, and not once did he thank me. I always remember even something like hearing about it from Gus Poyet, and obviously Harty stayed with us that long that he worked under Poyet. There was that, I think there was an Albion do, as end of season do. And he pointed out one player, and I can't remember who it was, so it's probably not right to say, oh, I think it was so-and-so. But he said, that person, he's a silly boy. He said, you know, he's got great talent, superb player, but he's such hard work. Points across to Gary Hart, he said, I wish I really had an entire squad of Gary Harts, because they are, he used the word, low maintenance. You know, they just get on with the game. You know, they get on with what they're supposed to do. They're asked to do something and they do it, and they'll do it willingly, and they'll run through, you know, walls for you. He said, I wish it was my time as a manager would be so much easier if I had a whole bunch of players like that. I suspect probably now it's something that Chris Heaton does have. But when you're talking about those third division players, then yeah, it's always going to be a little bit tricky. So
yeah, but I mean, then of course Bobby came back, and what was your making of Bobby the second coming?
It was very different, wasn't it? He was a very different player. He'd become, before he used to lead the line, and he was everywhere on the pitch, wasn't he? And then he became, particularly when he was at Fulham and the injuries he had, he became this kind of almost lumbering target man and goal poacher. And he was effective and he was good, and it was great to have him back, but it was almost, at times, when he'd come off the bench and kind of be, I don't want to be too unkind, but almost lumbering around, it was kind of sad to see someone who was so great.
You see, I disagree with that. I mean, I looked at Bobby coming back here, and, you know, there was that great Ferrari about the I'm back thing, which was terrific. But, I mean, it was the fact that he was back, it just helped... It created a mood around the place.
That's
it was
very
a feel-good thing. And it's like, you know, I mean, he did contribute on the pitch as well. He scored some important goals whilst he was in that spell. And, you know, he was just like a bit of a talisman to a certain degree. And it was, you know, he just helped create the mood that helped, I think, helped the whole crowd get back behind the team and get us across that line and eventually get us promoted.
Yeah, well, going back to the 15 years, you've got the same thing you're talking about, momentum. That's so important, isn't it? And for when Chris Hughton came in, and ever since, it's been that momentum that has been built up from that. And he was one of the signings that helped build that momentum that saw us into the Premier League.
Okay, well, one thing that we don't actually have at the moment is a momentum in our away form. And we went to Burnley this weekend, and, well, It was horrible, scruffy.
And one a bit like your jumper.
A bit like my jumper. Like, there's nothing wrong. This is quality threaded. For those who
don't have super reverb vision, Adia's got a Brighton & Hove Albion jumper on it. It's one of those sort of ghastly Christmas effort.
Yeah, this is a lovely jumper. So what did you make of the Burnley game? Did you make it up to Lancashire at the weekend?
I didn't know. I'm probably better for it with the weather and everything.
I mean the way performances this year they've not been great. Obviously we've had two away wins already this season, which is what we had in the whole of last season. But what do you put those away performances down to? Because I mean we seem to be playing a completely different style at home to what we are away. Chris will say differently, of course, but there seems to be a lot more intensity at home than away. What would you put that down to?
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I think we generally sit a little bit deeper away from home, and the fullbacks don't get forward as much, which then means that often a lot of the attacks are stopping before they've even started. And I think that makes it a lot more difficult. And when you see someone like Pascal Gross being so much more effective at the Amex than away from home, I think a lot of that is because when he's getting the ball away from home, it's not in the areas of the pitch which he's the most effective. And ultimately, that's what a lot of it comes down to for me. It's about being braver. And at home, maybe it's a mental thing, being comfortable and being drawn on by the crowd, but we're braver with getting the ball forward and making those runs forward and taking a chance.
Kieran, are you there?
I'm here
again. Yay! Kieran Maguire finally is on the other end of the line. We're just talking about our away performances against our home performances, Kieran. Now, you've seen a lot of us away this season. What would you put the lack of intensity away from home down to?
I think the setup of the team is slightly more cautious, and we are giving other teams not only possession, but if they create a couple of chances, it tends to increase the intensity of the crowd, so they get on the players. And it becomes a bit of a virtuous circle for the opposition. I think we've also got to accept that we are only in our second season in the Premier League, and mistakes are punished. So I was at Anfield, one mistake by Bissouma, we lost the match 1-0. I was at the Etihad, against a very good side, and we were very disciplined. We set out to create the occasional chance on the break. And on one occasion when we were pushing forwards, dispossessed, and 10 seconds later, it's in the net. Exactly the same at Goodison as well. So I think we've got to accept that the speed of the opposition tends to be far greater than we experience in the Championship. And also the ability to punish mistakes is far more severe.
Now, I mean, the game away at Liverpool, we actually played very, very well, actually. I mean, and we could have actually got something out of that game. Which there was certainly an element of, we didn't show necessarily the fear, possibly, that we might have done last season. But when we went away to Burnley this week, a team that's been low on confidence and not scoring goals, and yet we sit back and invite on the pressure.
Well, I think it was a Championship match masquerading as a Premier League game. Yeah. And I think to give the players some leeway, the conditions were atrocious. I mean, we were only 12 miles away from Accrington, and their match was called off due to the weather. It was absolutely tipping it down with rain. The winds are up as well, so skill was at a premium. And when you go to Burnley, you know exactly what you're going to get. So not having Shane Duffy did not help us. I mean, Balogun played well, but.
So are you suggesting that presence that Shane's got at set pieces this year, well, he's certainly causing an absolute menace at set pieces and corners and stuff, that it's three goals he's got this season, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, hi Kieran, what we're saying here is that with Shane, so when we're playing Burnley, I say, I think Kieran's absolutely spot on when he says it's a championship game. It's a classic crash bang wallop of Burnley. That it's not. They don't have the speed and pace of Chelsea and Manchester City and what have you. And they clearly punched above their weight last season. They did very, very well. I wouldn't say they've found their level. I think they're punching well below their weight this season. But it's the sort of game that would have suited Shane Duffy. It's the sort of game that would have suited, probably more so, and it's easy to be wise after the event, Glenn Murray. I mean, Andoni's quick, he's very good and what have you, but and let's face it, no one's going to criticise Houghton for it, because everyone was screaming for Andoni for the Burnley game, and yet it was more of a physical sort of, you know, I say crash bang wallop game. So, you know, whilst yes, Murray needed a rest because he's 100 years old, it actually still does underline the stupidity of Shane Duffy's behaviour against Palace. Because whilst we found it funny that, you know, it meant Balogun came on and we still did this and it was a brilliant tactical switch, we've lost him for this game, for Chelsea and for Bournemouth, and those are three games, well, probably for the rest of the season. He had so hitherto been our player of the season, arguably. And it's,
he's back for Bournemouth, by the way.
So what's the other game he's missing then?
It's today and Arsenal.
Isn't Bournemouth before Arsenal?
Oh yeah, Bournemouth next weekend.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
no, so he's back for Arsenal. Okay, yeah, but so yeah, I it would have been, and you know, we'd have possibly done a lot better at the set pieces and so on and so forth, because somehow, somewhere down the line, Duffy and Dunk are scoring goals where they're missing them with alarming regularity last season.
Okay, well, one thing that we were, that amuses me greatly, Phil, and we were just talking about with Dean and the success that we had there, was that our entire League One strike force was on the pitch on Saturday.
yeah, and I guess with Ashley Barnes, to a certain degree, familiarity sometimes breeds contempt a little bit with him. He was so effective for us under Poirier, and yet so effective also at missing great chances in front of goal at the same time. It's interesting that so many of those players have gone on to play in the Premier League and gone on to better things.
Yeah, Kieran, are you surprised that Ashley's gone on to be established as a Premier League player?
Not in the least. From a manager's point of view, he's an absolute diamond. He follows instructions, and he did that superbly for us under Gus. You know, he wanted to play as a striker, but he was prepared to play that role out wide on the left and still contribute with goals. Remember, in some seasons, he was our leading goal scorer. As far as Sean Dyche is concerned, he will always put in a shift. He's very physical. He upsets defenders. He moans a lot. He's a rough diamond, and for the price that Burnley paid for him, and also from the price that we paid for him for Plymouth, he's proven to be incredible value for money.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, I'm absolutely delighted to see that he's done well. Unfortunately,
yeah, but not
unfortunately,
for us.
He did actually get 3 points this week, which is devastating. Well, yeah. But okay, so I mean, the goal that Burnley did score was very much down to us not clearing our lines, Kieran.
Yes, it was very scrappy. If Matthew Ryan went for a long ball, half cleared it to the edge of the box, and then it came in, and Tarkowski just sort of ricocheted it past the defenders on the line. It was very messy. I think it was very much in keeping with the game, but we still had an hour from that point to get back. And the disappointing thing was that we did not create a single chance until right at the end, where Lacadia should have done a lot better with a superb cross from Glenn Murray.
Yeah, I mean, Glenn on the wing. Who knew Glenn had the pace to be a winger? I mean, it's an amazing thing. But I mean, okay, I mean, we've got to talk about the elephant in the room, and that is Lacadia miss. Now, I mean, a lot of people are just giving him an absolute dog's abuse at the moment now, which can't help his confidence. I'm still remain convinced there's a player in there, that we've just got to play in the right formation to get the best out of him, which we're clearly not. I mean, every time we've seen the best out of him, he's been playing alongside Glenn or alongside Leo Joa or alongside Andoni. He's looked good as part of a two. So, I mean, you can't. Yes, he should have scored that goal. I mean, it was an easy opportunity. But I mean, what do we do? How do you solve a problem like Jürgen?
I think.
Well, I mean, Jürgen was effectively brought in as Glenn's replacement. in the last January window. And I think part of the reason why he's not been getting game time is that Glenn has played so well. And that means that Leucadia has become marginalised. People are focusing on the fee, but you know, £14-16 million by Premier League standards is the going rate for you know, a journeyman striker at that level. I think if people are patient, then that's fine. So long as somebody's scoring the goal, I don't care whether it's Glenn Murray or Shane Duffy or Lewis Dunk or whoever.
I think Kieran, you know, makes
the important thing is the result.
I just got to mention that Anthony Ernesto has made it into the building.
Hi, Kieran. I think Kieran makes a great point, really, that whoever's scoring, I don't think fans, regardless of any club across the league, they don't care, do they? I think Leucadia's become this player that Albion fans love to sort of hate, and we always there's always one in the squad. I think the other point that I don't know if you've already made this is that he just doesn't look comfortable playing that on his own. He looks like the type of striker I've been out the room. I've been shopping in the open market.
And just pop in, yeah. It's a bit of a pop-in centre for the Stars. We're just waiting for the guy drinking special brew to come in a minute. But actually, I thought that was you. But
only in the North Stand.
Okay, I mean, one player that did have a very good performance and didn't quite make anything happen for us, but it was Solly March, and he's another one who's been getting quite a lot of pelters from various members of our support.
Absolutely, yeah. But again, if you look at, I love to quote statistics. You look at Solly March's stats, and you guys are always sort of going on about this. He's up there, isn't he, with some of the sort of the best players in the league. Players that you're talking £20-30 million. Solly March is okay. Not every one of his crosses, but that's football, isn't it? That's the nature of football, and to have sort of that local player. And
I think also what you've got is that there was an interview that was tweeted last night by Brian Owen with Glenn Murray, saying how frustrated he is because he sees Solly March training day in, day out, and he said he does some amazing things, and then when it comes to the pitch on Saturday, he doesn't do it. I mean, it's one of those things that professional footballers don't and shouldn't berate each other on the pitch, and you can see Murray's frustration because I think what he sees is Solly March is so much better than the player that's on the pitch. And I think he's probably got a point that we can see. We've seen him dance in between players and then sort of stick a beauty up into the top corner. And he doesn't do it week in, week out. It will come. And when it comes, then his star will rise way beyond where we're at now.
So you just mentioned players dancing, and now I'm singing Basuma. Why is that?
Well, we've got the choir outside as well. So
it's all going on here. Kieran, have you got carolers at your front door today?
No, I'm just in my room I've got my dog at my feet, and he's trying to nick my bacon sandwich at present.
Okay, well, we'll leave the Burnley game there. And you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast.
Before we do Shirt of the Week, I've got to mention Hat of the Week. Now, again, for those who have not got Super Reverb Vision, because it doesn't exist, Anthony has just wandered in doing his Christmas shopping, and he has a very, very fetching BHA Ruffians hat. We'll take a picture and put it on our website later, with headphones on. It looks very radio-like, with a lovely sort of pink and white bobble on the top there. It's in the pattern is the old Chewitz wrapper from, you know, the disgusting playoff thing, with the sort of like the TSB-style BHA Ruffians. He looks very fetching in it. Anthony, can anyone else get a hold of this hat?
Absolutely, yeah. They're on sale now. They're made in the UK, handmade in the UK. They're very limited edition. They're available via the NSK BHA Big Cartel website. So if you just put that into Google, NSK BHA Big Cartel.
Now, so you mean you can't get it from oldfootballhats.com?
No, there's an idea.
It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But, of course, we are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirt.com. And Phil has given... I tell you what, this shirt, I love it. Absolutely love it. So who wants it?
Okay, give it to Phil.
Here you go, yeah. Phil. You're the
Could
raw
you
virgin.
Just describe that for us?
Oh, well, it's a lovely sort of royal blue, almost purple colour.
Is that your printer again, AD?
No, it's blue.
Blue. It's got some nice Adidas stripes along the sleeves and a lovely oversized white collar.
It's very
1980s. Yeah, yeah. And then in the middle, you've got a kind of almost I can't think of the word for it. Almost a devil's sort of
Oh, a trident.
It's a trident.
Yes, it's a trident. Yes, like Neptune's trident.
With a head stuck on
with
top
a huge
of it.
Club Mediterranean around
menacing.
That. So one assumes this is a Mediterranean club.
Yeah. Phil, did you.
Kieran, it's Kieran at the other end there.
Kieran, have you got. Did you get the image I sent you?
Yes, yeah, it reminds me a lot of the Albion shirt for the last two seasons when we were in the old Division One.
You see, it's funny you should say that, because that's exactly what Phil has got to say.
Right.
He says, here is your shirt of the week. Vaguely familiar, I would say. I guess the Adidas sales rep at the time also visited Sussex by the Sea. Anyone want to guess who it is?
I actually know, because I saw the email, so I'm not going to guess.
Is it Danish?
No, it's not Danish.
Greek. Is it Greek?
It's not Greek, no.
Oh. Oh, it's the Medusa, head on the spike.
that's just what we want to do to most of our politicians at the moment, but never mind. Okay, this is the 1979 to 1980 home shirt of Corsican side Sporting Club Bastias, more commonly known as Bastia. They play in the Amateur Championnat National 3, which is the fifth tier of football in France, and they go by three nicknames, Ischacini and Les Bleus. Both of which translate to, well, the Blues. And also, I Leoni di Fiorani, which is the Lions of Fiorani, the region of Corsica from which they come. Their home ground is the Stade Armand Cesari, which is a capacity of 16,480, which is not bad for a fifth-tier French side, I would say.
Well, I can't help thinking that's actually quite a crash and burn. I'm sure you're going to get to the history, but I'm certain they got to the European Cup final, at least one of the European League club finals years ago.
Yeah, this is true. But a bit about that stadium. The stadium is most well known for the Fiorani disaster, which was on the 5th of May 1992. One of the four terraces collapsed, killing 18 and injuring over 2,000 others. That's terrible. This was a temporary stand specifically installed for the French Cup semi-final. Bastia have made it to five French Cup finals, losing all of them. Lucky them. They've played in UEFA tournaments and boasted some of the great players in their time. Recent players of note include Michael Essien, Roger Miller, Alex Song, also former Arsenal centre-half Sebastian Scalacci, Christian Carambu, formerly of Real Madrid, Sampdoria and Middlesbrough. And the all-time greatest Bastia player is regarded as Claude Papy, the one club player making 479 appearances, scoring 155 goals between 1967 and 1982. Brighton have never played Bastia, but however, on an Albion pre-season tour of southern France in 1976, Andy Rollins won 10 francs in a game of balls with them.
Phil, behave yourself.
That's actually a true story.
Is it?
Yeah.
I've got a feeling, I could be wrong here, and I can't remember the exact club, but I think if we go back to our good friend Louis Miles, in his Kaiser film, there was a Corsican connection with the Brazilian footballer. I'm thinking, yeah, I couldn't remember what it was, and it might not be with Bastia, but just in case it was, I'm going to throw that link in there as well.
Yeah, Louis Miles and the Mafia. Who knew? it's a crazy. Now, Kieran, with big news this week, of course, is the club finances have been announced for the last year. Now, I was looking at your research into this, and I made the mistake of printing off the Brighton 2017-18 What Do I Get thing. It's a book, Kieran. I read the first page. So why don't you just give me the greatest hits?
The greatest hit is that the Albion's income has gone shooting up as a result of being in the Premier League. So in the Championship, we made £8 million from TV. In the Premier League, it's 110. So it's for the first time in living memory, the Albion's actually made a genuine profit, which is great news for Tony Bloom. But Tony's still dipped his hand into his pocket and stuck a further £32 million into the club over the course of the season, which is A, incredibly generous, but B, shows that getting to the Premier League is one thing, but being able to compete there also means that, you know, we're very fortunate to have a genuine fan in Tony who's willing to back the manager in getting players in early and building the infrastructure of the club to make sure that hopefully we'll be there for more than one season.
Now, Kieran, in order to turn the profit, I mean, obviously there are other factors involved in that. And when you look at our budgets compared to other clubs in division, like, for instance, a small club like Crystal Palace, how does it actually compare?
Well, the Albion had the fifth lowest playing budget in the division. And I think that's what a number of fans seem to forget. They're saying, well, we're paying these players big wages, so why are we not playing a more expansive game? Why are we not winning more games? And the reason is with Brighton Hove Albion, we're in the bottom six in terms of having a wages budget. That will go up this season. We have improved the squad. But it's simply really tough to compete. There's at least three players at Palace who are on more than £100,000 a week.
Ouch.
We don't have that type of budget, and we don't have that type of dressing room, but it does show the difficulty of competing at this level.
So basically what you're saying is you don't come to Brighton for the money.
Well, you'll be pretty well remunerated, but...
much more than the rest of us, believe me.
Yeah, it's true. Go on.
If you take a look at what Palace have done, they've managed to keep Zaha by paying him an estimated £120,000 a week. They paid £30 million to Benteke, and they are paying him wages which were on a par with what he was earning at Liverpool. And they picked up
Max Meyer, yeah.
Who looks a decent player, but because he came, I think, on a free transfer, he's making it up with huge wages. Kabayi was paid a huge sum. Sissoko, whatever his name is, he's on huge money as well because he came from Liverpool. And that's not being critical of Palace. They have that is their business strategy, which is to put all of their money into the playing squad and not invest in the infrastructure. And that will be fine for them so long as they stay in this division.
Sure. Sorry, Kieran, I just want to take you back to a point you made just now about Tony Bloom's generosity. Now, I think the figure that has since been bandied about that the club is effectively in hock to him or he is throwing in something like £318 million, which is kind of eye-watering and nice if you can actually find that down the back of the sofa. But are you just saying that with the £32 million he put in, and the £12 million that's being reported as a profit, that we can actually make a straight sort of link that if he hadn't put that in, we'd still be reporting a £20 million loss? Is it that straightforward?
No. Without wanting to get into the nuances of financial reporting, they're actually completely independent. He put the money in because, first of all, the Albion did have an overdraft at the end of the Championship season because they paid out a load of bonuses and they'd started to make movements to improve the stadium. He didn't want an overdraft because if you owe money to the banks, then they're going to charge you interest. That's a Tony's view, is he'd rather put the money in himself. Mm. And so they're actually completely independent of one another. It's simply good business sense. We're fortunate that he's got a few spare quid to be able to do that, because If you look at some other clubs, they are paying huge sums of money to banks in respect of interest. Manchester United, since the Glazers have taken over, have given the banks their £700 million in interest. And by not taking such an approach, it means that every penny can be focused on the playing squad, on coaching, on training, on medical facilities, and things of that nature.
No, it's when you're talking about sort of interest, you're just thinking shades of Bill Archer sort of milking the club when, we really couldn't afford it. But again, getting back to a point you made just now about the way that the Crystal Palace was set up. Now, it's one of those things I find absolutely incredible. Like you say, that they've thrown everything at the players' wages. And yet when you've got then, for instance, Tony and the board are prepared to invest in things like helping out with the Albion community and investing in the women's football team, and yet then Crystal Palace are almost having to rely on Zaha's money. So it's almost as if all the investment that's going on in Palace infrastructure or in the community is actually going through Wilfred Zaha rather than through the club. I mean, surely theirs is a business model that's actually doomed to failure, is it not?
Well, it does mean that you're very reliant upon very few people to keep on delivering. And fair play to Zaha, first of all, for his generosity towards the women's team. I think it's a superb gesture from him. And also, I think, whilst he's our love-to-hate figure, he's an exceptionally talented footballer and is being paid accordingly. But if, you know, if he does suffer an injury or he suffers a loss of form, then I think Palace are going to struggle. You know, they have spent money on other players as well, which has been a bit more hit and miss. And just because you're paying somebody £100,000 a week, there's no guarantee, as they've seen with Benteke this season and last season, that he's necessarily going to deliver in terms of goals, and it makes them, you know, looking a wee bit exposed.
Yeah, it's bizarre because was there a game last week against them? What happened?
Couldn't remember.
Oh yeah, the game.
Well, 10 of us lot turned up.
Yeah. Well, basically, after we beat Palace last week, it was I made a point of listening to one of the Palace shows.
Which one was it? Five-year plan.
Yeah. Which was, but I mean, the Kevin Day, who's actually been a good friend to the Albion over the years.
Yeah, I think he wants us to keep that quiet. Yeah. You know.
So. But it was, but he was actually spitting feathers about the fact that, you know, he says, look at Brighton, look at their budget, look at what they're spending
the
on
infrastructure,
players.
But
they're not, you know, they. But look at what they've got. They've got the banqueting facilities. They've got the whole stadium, which they can use on non-match days. They're making all this revenue from this, that, and the other, from that's not football related.
Palace's 5-year plan. Their 5 years of being in the Premier League is just to basically pay players a lot of wages.
Yeah,
so.
Phil.
And it's. I think if you read Tony Bloom's chairman statements in the accounts, one of the things that he speaks about this, about the Albion, is that they're investing in people, they're investing in the infrastructure, they're investing in and it's all about the culture of the club. And I think that all creates a culture in which you don't just see it with the men's first team, with the women's team, and with all the youth teams and the disability specific teams, that it creates a culture where success is natural, because it makes it the most productive culture for everyone.
Kieran?
I agree entirely. You know, the Albion are basing their, that they do have a business strategy, and that actually is based upon four central areas, which is people, process, infrastructure and performance, whereby I think that Palace are very much focused on performance. And getting people in the form of players, but not necessarily having people behind the scenes who have the same level of sort of business acumen and success. You know, Tony is a very smart businessman, and he wants smart people around him to build the club. So as a result, I think that Palace are looking weak on infrastructure, and I think they're looking weak on the processes, because their recruitment policy appears to be a bit, we've got a rotating manager approach, and you know, the trouble is when you're changing the manager on a regular basis, he's got players he likes and dislikes. So that's going to cause them issues as far as the transfer market is concerned. You know, and as much as we like to tease Palace, we've all got mates who are Palace fans. And, you know, I know that they're pretty fed up, because I think they feel that they're getting a short straw. And after, you know, they've done well. Yeah, they've had a number of seasons now in the Premier League. But what have they got to show for it? Yeah, they originally had Zaha, they've still got him. And apart from him, there's not a lot else.
That seems to be their major achievement, is actually just retaining, retaining the services of Zaha. I mean,
I think they'd be better off without him, to be honest. I think it's become a noose around their neck.
No, I think it's quite the opposite. He's the one that's actually propping him up. He's the one that has actually, you know, making sure that he keeps the lever of the trap door sort of, you know, to closed. I mean, because they've also got the plans to build effectively a West Stand, you know, an Amex West Stand, and they've got to find the money for that. And they're as much as they were talking about, oh, we're going to be starting work in November, any Brighton fan that looked at those plans and said, well, okay, fine, they look good. I mean, it doesn't necessarily improve the ground, because you're still talking about four individual sheds around a swamp. But what you're talking about is something that is never going to get through planning in the first instance, in the first hit. And Steve Parrish is making these promises he can't keep, and then he throws in this stuff about, you know, the Holmesdale fanatics and moving other people. I mean, it's not even just sort of the infrastructure, let's say the people thing it's a total mess. It's not even investing, he's divesting in the whole notion of a people strategy, and that is basically the fans. What you do not do at a football club is upset the supporters.
Right, Gary?
Sorry.
I agree with everything Al said. And this isn't gloating, because it's Palace. You could look at many other football clubs,
Charlton,
in the Premier
one,
League, yeah, where they've done similar. But to give you a rough idea of where we are, Yet the Albion last season, they spent £56 on wages for every £100 that came in through the turnstiles and through the TV money.
Top stat.
And at Palace, it's 78. So there is a huge difference. Yeah. The average Palace player is on £15,000 a week. You know, that's over the whole squad compared to the Albion.
Yeah. Sure. Now, Kieran, myself and Al hosted an evening with Chris Catlin and Andy Rollins this week. And one of the interesting things that came out that Cat was saying, and that show will be out sometime.
Probably
next year,
at the end of January next year.
But I mean, one of the things that Cat was saying was when he was brought in, one of his remits was he had to get pretty much break up the cup final squad because they're on too much money. And you know, and we saw the likes of Brian Horton,
Steve Foster, Jimmy Case.
Jimmy Case didn't go immediately, but
no, but I mean, Catlin still had to offload him.
Yeah, so but I'm just looking at one of the stats you've got here. The player signings last year, 57.5 million, player sales, 3.5 million. It's chalk and cheese, isn't it?
That very, very much so. And I think one of the great things about what we have seen at the Albion over the past 2 or 3 years is that Tony has backed Chris Hughton. We easily could have sold Anthony Knockart and Lewis Dunk in the season that we went up, and we wouldn't have been promoted. And it's keeping faith in those players. And I think effectively what was said to them by Tony and Paul Barber was, come on, lads, give us one more season in the Championship, and if we don't make it this year, then you're free to go with our blessing. Yeah, we're not going to stop you from achieving a player's ambition of playing at the highest level. So the players showed faith in Tony and Paul, and they did vice versa. We've been promoted, and those players have gone on to establish themselves in this division. I think what we are seeing now is that there are other clubs starting to circle some of our prize assets, so who knows what's going to happen over the course of the next 12 months.
Circle the wagons, that's what we're going to do. But I mean Kieran, I mean the thing is, and you Phil here as well, the fact is that we did manage to retain Lewis Dunk here, and he's gone on to be a fantastic player for us, which we already knew, but he also proved that you can actually become an England international, and he didn't have to move.
Exactly, and I think to give Gareth Southgate some credit, he's given opportunities to players who are not from the elite, and also those players who've been prepared to go overseas. So we've now got players from Leicester and Burnley and the Albion appearing in the England squad and feeling part of that, and that's very encouraging. And I think that must be good for younger England players coming through who are wondering whether they should stay at perhaps what they consider to be one of the big six clubs, or perhaps dropping down a tier to the likes of the Albion and so on, and knowing that the England manager will still show faith in them.
Phil?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the England squad, not just the one that Lewis Dunk was in, but the England squad pretty much since Gareth Southgate has become manager, it shows that he has given faith to players that are playing for some of the more provincial clubs. And as you say, even down, lower down the leagues, I think it's only good for teams like Brighton, and I guess probably it's probably influenced by the fact that he what the sort of clubs that he played for, including them lot down the road. I guess.
I think I just want to expand on the point of Gareth Southgate. Generally, here we are, at the end of 2018. Is there anyone probably within English football who an Englishman within English football whose star has risen so dramatically over these past 12 months? I mean, when he got the England gig on the back of some more nonsense that only the FA could actually concoct, he was just considered and dismissed as an England blazer. And yes, we're not world beaters yet, but we got to the World Cup semi-final. We had a fantastic World Cup. The whole country was behind them. The beer throwing and the football's coming home. And here we are, all right, you might consider the European Nations League a little bit Mickey Mouse, but hey, we got through Spain and Croatia. And you can see that the trajectory within the England national team setup is only on the rise. And it is down to the intelligent foresight that Gareth Southgate has got, that you don't actually have to have the only the people from the elite, only the people who, you know, they might sit well in their club, but, you know, not in the system that he wants to play. And I think that he has actually got the whole country interested in the England team again. And I just hope that actually we can look at this realistically rather than the usual sort of nationalistic fervour nonsense that we have about how great we are and England's a world force in football, because it still really isn't. But the fact is that he's actually licked our wounds and actually made us believe in the England side again. And I think that actually that is almost certainly down to him and his programme. And yet, what was he dismissed as? Just an England blazer. Now he's the England waistcoat. It's, I think Gareth Southgate is absolutely, you know, brilliant. I mean, for me, he's probably the English football person of the year. I mean, in whatever way you want to sort of concoct an award for him. But
is he down for sports personality of the year?
Well, no, because he's not a player. But, you know, if there was a management thing, then maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I think that Gareth Southgate's done a brilliant job. And it's not just in picking Lewis Dunk, who's one of our own, etc., etc. But he's actually, you know, got everyone largely facing the same way, except the Express and the Mail, who still pick on England players. But that's another matter entirely.
You look at other players in that squad, the likes of Jadon Sancho, for instance. I mean, he's had to go to Germany in order to actually play first team football.
Has he had to, or has he preferred to?
Well, no, he chose to.
Well, that's my point. So he hasn't had to.
But I mean, would he have got the same opportunities getting at the moment if he'd stayed at Man City?
Well, I think if you look at the number of players that are coming through, it's probably and the fact that they are getting the opportunities to go to leagues like Germany and that sort of thing. It's part of that is a testament to the work that Gareth Southgate did when he was involved in the under-21 team and the youth structure. And I think part of that we're seeing that is just that there are better young players coming through.
I mean, we talk a lot about on the show about pathway, Kieran, and about how we can get the players from our youth setup into our first team. And you know, we've got a classic player with the likes of Aaron Connolly at the moment, who's certainly knocking on the door.
Yeah, but he's Ireland, mate.
I'm talking about the young players coming through here.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Generally speaking, and the pathway through to the first team. You know, I don't think there's not too many English players in our academy.
No, probably not, but
Which is more splitting.
But Kieran,
I'd like to see.
So with all the reports and what have you that you've seen, and reading between the lines of the financial report that you've just read, how do you see the next two or three years? Not necessarily on the field, but sort of assuming that we stay in the Premier League, how do you see it going for the Albion?
I think it's actually now going to get tougher, because when we came up with players who were on Championship wages, who were given a pay rise up to a Premier League level. But now that we are trying to recruit better players, you know, I think incremental gains is, I know it's a sort of a managerial piece of nonsense to many, but that's what the Albion are trying to do now. You know, last year we had a good 16 to 18 players. Now we're looking for a good 20 to 22. Then they're going to look to have, you know, a full 25 who will be fairly interchangeable. And to do that, the wage cost is going to go up. If you're recruiting players from overseas, you know, players tend to be a bit bitchy. They'll be knocking on Tony's door and Paul Barber's door saying, well, you know, you just recruited such and such a player and he's on £5,000 a week more than I am, so I want a pay rise. So I think it's going to be tough for the Albion. And also, a lot will depend on where we are in the league, because if we are knocking around between 10th and 12th, it actually means that the TV companies aren't interested in us. They're interested in Champions League qualification, and they're interested in relegation scraps. So if you are, you know, for want of a better word, if the Albion metamorphise into Watford, it's actually going to be that much more difficult to generate extra money, because we're not tickling the ends of either end of the table. So the TV companies aren't interested. And if the TV companies aren't interested, then it becomes harder to sell to commercial sponsors. So I think the club have got a big challenge on their hands, but I do think they've got the right people, because that's how Tony's invested, you know, because he has not just gone on the performance on the pitch issue. I think behind the scenes there's a lot of smart cookies there who do seem to have a plan.
Okay, we're going to leave that one there, Kieran. So
heaven forfend that we should ever become Stoke City. Let's put it that way.
It's not going to happen. Please don't let it happen. Please don't let it. So we'll leave it there. So thanks very much, Kieran, for that. And of course,
we'll catch you tomorrow, mate. We'll catch you in the Chelsea game.
Yes. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Are you in the disabled area tomorrow with your crutches, or are you?
I've not asked to be, I'm taking a look at some of those stairs. I might have to have a quiet word with the steward when I get there.
Sure.
What, they're going to give you a piggyback?
No. Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Kieran. Well,
many thanks for that, Kieran.
Anytime,
Jeff. Oh, cheers.
Cheers. Da-da.
That was football finance expert Kieran Maguire. He's a media darling, isn't he? Well, we just got enough time to talk about blogs.
Fill the tweeting seagull, which I say is not an instruction. Listen,
exactly
mate,
tweeting, as we
the floor is yours. Tell us about your blog.
Yeah, well, I started writing my blog in about April of this year, I think it was. And I guess I started it for a similar reason that yourselves do this show and Kieran writes about football finance. It comes from a place of passion about the Albion that we've already spoken about, and passion for football, and I think often what I try and write about is just my experiences of the Albion, and as I've said, a lot of what people will talk about in the national media about the club will be things that happened before I became a fan, you know, 97, sure. and certainly the Goldstone and the 83 Cup final. And I think that, as you said before, every fan has their own story, and the club has, every football club in this country, really. We're lucky to have such a depth of domestic football, and every club has its own unique culture and identity. And I guess what I try and get over in my blog, and I think there's some other good ones out there as well, that talk about the Albion and other clubs, that just try and get that their story of the club across.
I mean,
they're
all very interesting. I mean, I've read most of your stuff, and it's great. I mean,
it's very much
opinion pieces, isn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of opinion pieces and writing about previous games and previous players that have happened in the past, and people that have played for the club. And I guess what I quite like about blogs in comparison to, say, just Twitter or social media is that because I spend a few days writing it and I'm rewriting it and I'm looking at it, and I'll go away and come back to it, I find it's a bit more considered than you know, the instant social media.
So where can we read about your blog?
So it's tweetingseagull.wordpress.com, or find me on Twitter at tweetingseagull.
Brilliant. So if you do actually want to read a really good sort of Albion-related blog, then there you go. We've got several more, but the Tweeting Seagull, do check him out.
Yeah, and that is actually all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much for joining us, Phil, to Alan, to Kieran, to Anthony. I've been Ady Packham, and we will see you all again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.